Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. From the Korean Institute of Oriental Medicine comes a study published in the American Journal of Chinese Medicine that shows the antiviral activity in aloe vera. This is a very important piece of information because we want as many different functional foods, meaning they function in a way that benefits the body, to be able to be consuming them on a daily basis, especially now when we're into flu season and we don't want influenza A or B because they can be deadly. They are. They kill tens of thousands of people in the United States each year. And also with the coronavirus, we want to protect ourselves as best as possible. So I'll give you the latest on that and a lot of other topics to allow us to live a longer and healthier life. And I might mention every single day when I share information on health, this always is new material. I don't use old material. So you're getting state-of-the-art, highly qualified material from peer-reviewed literature every day we're on the air. Also today, we're going to examine some other topics. We're going to listen to James Corbett. He is an outstanding journalist, about contact tracing. Because contact tracing is already in place. They're hiring thousands of people in California to trace anyone that tests positive. And yet the test they're using is not a gold standard, 100% accurate test. It has a wide margin of error and is being misinterpreted. So we have deemed something a pandemic, closed down our economy based upon incomplete, inaccurate, or out-and-out fraudulent statistics. Yes, coronavirus is real. Yes, it can kill people, but those with comorbidities who are already sick, not healthy people. That is a rare exception. More people die each year of the flu, especially younger people and otherwise healthy people, from the flu virus than coronavirus. And yet everyone is being told what to do and why. What is their agenda? We'll discuss that. So we have some other things we'll be sharing with you as well. But we always begin with the latest on health and healing. And with that, in a recent study, the Korean Institute of Oriental Medicine explored another use of aloe vera, something that isn't as widely discussed, but is just as significant as its beneficial effects on the skin, or, for example, for digestive problems or turning off inflammation in the stomach. The researchers screened aloe vera for the active compounds responsible for its antiviral activities, particularly against influenza A. Now, as I just mentioned, influenza A is a virus that attacks the respiratory system and is one of the most common causes of the flu. Influenza A infections can be serious, deadly, and can cause widespread outbreaks. Previous studies have found that the ethanolic extract of aloe vera has significant anti-influenza activity. But the mechanisms underlying this activity and the constituents responsible for it are still unknown. In an earlier study, the researchers found that AVE treatment significantly reduced the replication of green fluorescent protein-labeled influenza A virus in Mandan-Carby canine kidney cells. They also noted that post-treatment of aloe vera inhibited the expression of viral matrix protein 1 and matrix protein 2. So the influenza virus, M1, is known to mediate viral budding, a process that enables the virus to exit its host cell. Influenza virus M2, on the other hand, facilitates the migration of genetic materials from the virus itself into its target cell. In this study, it was shown that aloe vera can inhibit autophagy induced by influenza A in MDCK cells. By the way, autophagy is a natural process employed by your body to clean out damaged and unnecessary cell components. It kind of like comes in and house cleans your cells. This process helps control viral infection by causing the destruction of viruses. So this is just some of the good things that aloe vera can do. And by the way, aloe vera, along with quercetin, Q-U-E-R-C-E-T-I-N, and catechin hydrate, catechin, C-A-T-E-C-H-I-N, and camphorol, K-A-E-M-P-F-E-R-O-L, are aloe vera's active antiviral components. That's good news that they have found of the hundreds of phytonutrients in almost every food with aloe, those are the ones that are most active. And against M1, M2 in particular. So, just one more reason that if you can, going into the season where the weather changes and people turn on the heat and they haven't cleaned out their vents with hydrogen peroxide or diluted bleach sprays in their car or in their home, forgetting that for the last 6 months or longer that that air conditioner heater has been off, bacteria and molds have been growing. You turn it on and suddenly millions of particulate matter are spread into the air. And that's why frequently when a person's been all right all day and then they come in and turn on it at night, wake up in the morning with stuffed nose and stuffed head and congestion. It was that heating system not being cleaned. So now you can take your aloe vera each day. Also from the National Institutes, University of Singapore, comes a study about neem, N-E-E-M. It's a plant. It's used in medicinal medicine. But they found that by consuming a bioactive compound from neem, you could significantly suppress development of prostate cancer. So by orally administering what is called nimbolide, N-I-M-B-O-L-I-D-E, over 12 weeks, you reduce prostate tumor size by up to 70%. Mind you, this is for people who have prostate cancer. 70% with a non-toxic natural substance? Yeah. And it also decrease the tumor metastasis by 50%. There's a team of international researchers led by Professor Sethi from the Department of Pharmacology at the Yong Lo Lin School of Medicine at the National University in Singapore. They found that the nimbolide, the bioactive, what is called a terpenoid compound derived from the indica, or more commonly known as the neem plant, could reduce the size of prostate tumors by up to 70% and suppress its spread or metastasis by 50%. And just so you know, prostate cancer is one of the most commonly diagnosed cancers worldwide. However, currently, therapies for metastatic prostate cancer are only marginally effective. Hence, there is a need for more novel treatment of alternatives and options. And so this is just one. And that's good. And by the way, your cell division and migration are the key steps during tumor metastasis. And in this study, it revealed that the nimbolide can significantly suppress cell invasion and migration of prostate cancer cells. So it reduces tumor metastasis. All good news. And by the way, neem, N-E-E-M, the plant, belongs to the mahogany tree family that is originally native to India and the Indian subcontinent. It's been part of traditional Asian medicine for centuries and is typically used in Indian Ayurvedic medicine. And today, neem leaves and the neem bark have been incorporated into many personal care products like soaps, toothpaste, skin care, and even dietary supplements. So, just something else that's important. From Columbia University comes a study that the Mediterranean diet predicts better sleep quality in U.S. women. So according to Columbia University, and this originated from Columbia University's Irvine Medical Center, the research, quote, consumption of a Mediterranean diet has been linked to better sleep health in older European populations. this was important because the Mediterranean diet is really just not exclusively by any means, because seafood is also in there, and they'll eat some dairy. But when you go to Italy, and especially into the country, you will see that the people are very aware of the dangers of different pesticides, having things more organic, which is a natural tradition. They call it clean food, and they do the ultimate. Well, you have to include Spain and, to a lesser degree, France into some of the healthiest food anywhere, but slow eating, eating together with your family and friends, taking your time, not rushing, taking your time with the cooking. And the people go to the farmer's market. I remember once my friend knocked on my door. It was 4 o'clock in the morning. I was staying at his place in France. And he said, "You want to see how the average person eats? Let me show you." So we drove into town, just a few minutes away. And there, even though it was pitch black, there were all kinds of activities going on. All these small stalls where people were setting up. Now, in the United States, you know, the farmer's market set up, you know, around 8 o'clock in the morning. There, they're up and going by 5 o'clock. And the place was packed. And people would be looking and testing all the food and taking samples and trying them. And so they're very connoisseurs of food. So Columbia University is saying, try the Mediterranean diet, high in beans and whole grains and vegetables, seasonings, olive oil, olives. Yeah, you're going to be healthier. And that's good news. Just getting people off the diet is important. From Emory University and the University of Notre Dame, bayberry, B-A-Y, B-E-R-R-Y, it's a leaf, it's an herb, offers hope against growing antibiotic resistance. Scientists at Emory University, in conjunction with the University of Notre Dame, presented an exciting research manuscript that was published in the American Chemical Society's Infectious Disease Journal. The peer-reviewed report is another scientifically validated example of the plant kingdom's intelligence when it comes to healing the body. The research delivered hopeful findings detailing how a common shrubbery, the American beautyberry or bayberry, has potent properties that make it a powerful ally in the fight against antibiotic resistance. In their laboratory test, researchers observed that compounds extracted from bayberry leaf work to boost the efficacy of antibiotics against resistant strains of bacteria, specifically MRSA, M-R-S-A, that's methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. And that kills tens of thousands of Americans every year. So that's important. So native plants have important usage, and it's being supported in the United States in our good research here, because resistance to antibiotics is a medical apocalypse. We've used too many antibiotics where it shouldn't have been used. They've been used against viral infections where they don't work at all, yet that kills the good bacteria when it's used wrong, and then that's important. In fact, according to the CDC, at least 2.8 million people get an antibiotic-resistant infection, and more than 35,000 people die from it each year. So try not to take antibiotics unless it's known to be beneficial against the virus you have and not against bacteria. From Oregon State University comes a study published in Scientific Reports that vitamin E is needed for proper nervous system development. Now, this is extremely important and has key ramifications for women of childbearing age. Findings from the Oregon State University scientists show that embryos produced by vitamin E deficient zebrafish have malformed brains and nervous systems. According to the researchers, quote, "This is totally amazing. The brain is absolutely physically distorted by not having enough vitamin E." And this was from a Dr. Traber, professor in the College of Public Health and Human Sciences. And by the way, the zebrafish is a small freshwater species that go from fertilized egg to a swimming fish in about 5 days. And they are highly prized for studying the development of genetics of vertebrates because they share remarkable similarity to humans at the molecular and genetic and cellular levels, meaning many findings are immediately relevant to humans. And so just understand that this vitamin E, by the way, discovered in 1922, has been identified because it's an essential for fertilizing the eggs to culminate in live births. So that's what's important. By the way, does anybody in this audience, this takes you back a ways, 1974, when I held a symposium all day in the ballroom at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, where I brought in people who had made major discoveries with vitamins, like the Shute brothers, the two cardiologists from Canada, Wilford and Evan, who had done more work on vitamin E than any other scientist in the world. And what was remarkable in the 3,300 monographs they were showing and distributing was that gangrene and heart disease and intermittent claudication, all these conditions, they were able to reverse completely with high-dose vitamin E, and some of the doses were up to 3,000 units a day. And yet none of this was in the scientific literature in America. People were using 30 units of vitamin E. In fact, when I was on Johnny Carson, he commented about, you mean vitamin E really does that? And I said, yes, but we've been using too little. So I became an advocate for the scientists using vitamin E and clinicians using it and recommending it to use higher doses. We were using 30, 60, 100 milligrams was considered an astronomical dose. And yet I was finding in my own clinical practice that I only saw results starting at 400 units and going up. But it took a while, so he talked about vitamin E. Albert Sangiorgi, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering ascorbic acid, vitamin C, talked about vitamin C. Dr. Ellis on the B-complex, a doctor from University of Texas who had invented or discovered seven vitamins, was there. I had all told about 12 presenters, and it took all day for them to present their information. My hope was that people in the mainstream media would cover the event and realize that there was far greater use of vitamins than what we were using because we were using too low a dosage. Were any of you there? I'd like to hear if you were. Also, I was just thinking about someone who's attending the anti-aging clinical study, the short version, two-week one, reminded me of he was in the audience as one of the supporters when I was the regular debater for the health, natural health, on the Morton Downey Show. The executive producer was a friend of mine, Peter Goldsmith, by the way, he was the first producer to really do the reality shows. And in fact, this was one of those, the Morton Downey Show. Morton was a fair guy. He really did his homework. And Peter said, we want the best of both sides to debate. And that particular night, there was this huge lawyer, like 300 pounds, and he had been the leading lawyer attacking and going after the licenses of all the holistic doctors in the country, especially in New York, which had more holistic doctors, Warren Levin and Stuart Berger and Robert Giller and Robert Atkins. All of these people were attacked. And so that night it was about cancer, and that all these alternative cancer therapies were quackery. In the audience that night, unbeknownst to him, was a medical doctor, a board-certified psychologist, PhD. They were completely cured patients of Dr. Emmanuel Ribisi, and there were at least 80 people there who were cured patients of Dr. Ribisi with their medical records. Mind you, Ribisi didn't make the diagnosis. These were people who were diagnosed and treated at other cancer centers like Sloan Kettering, but had not succeeded. They were sent home to die, went to Dr. Emmanuel Ribisi, and they were cured. In any case, at some point during the discussion, because I had the proof and then I showed the American Cancer Society, which was used as an example of quackery, I said, I went to visit the man who heads that list. He had never visited, nor spoken to, nor read anything, nor interviewed any patient of any of the doctors that were on his unproven cancer management list. I said, that is just not, that's non-scholarship, that's non-research. And yet, here are living people. The guy lost it, ran across the stage, if you remember, and hit me in the chest. And I went down. I wasn't expecting it. And then in that moment, a hand from the audience said, stay down, stay down. You got a lawsuit. You have this guy arrested. He assaulted you. And I thought to myself, no, we'll win, but not by some cheap theatrics. And so I got back up. Well, I want to tell you, there were a group of lawyers there that night representing the doctors who were being attacked. And they came over later and says, why didn't you stay down? He'd be in handcuffs and disgrace. I said, that's not how you win, because it'd be someone else taking his place tomorrow. There's unlimited amounts of people out there who work for the cancer establishment. So you got to look at the, you know, not look at one little victory, but rather look at the battle we're in. We have to have an educational program based upon facts, based upon good research, based upon clinical studies that show that alternative and complementary medicine works with all diseases. This time it's cancer. So at that time I had written along with Robert Houston. By the way, Bob is a very self-effacing, low-key guy. He's the brother of Jean Houston, one of the great leaders, the spiritual feminist leaders of the second wave of feminism, and she was right up there with Fritjof Capra, The Turning Point, Marilyn Ferguson, The Aquarian Conspiracy, George Leonard, The Silent Thread, Michael Murphy, Esalen, all those people who were in the 1970s and early 80s who really were legitimate. And Jean Houston was one of the most insightful, intelligent, brilliant voices. But her brother is equally brilliant. He's a scholar, and he and I worked together on the first article in American History, a national article, that took on the cancer establishment. I'm talking about Benno Schmidt, the president's cancer advisory board, all the companies making chemotherapy, the National Cancer Institute, the American Cancer Society. We took them all on in an article, and nobody would publish it. No liberal publication would publish it, including Mother Jones. We went to the Atlantic magazine, Harper's. Nobody would touch it because if you take on the cancer establishment, it was a sacred cow. But we found from a person inside the cancer establishment, in fact, inside the American Cancer Society, his name was Pat McGrady Sr. He was the top person in public relations there for 25 years. He sat with me. His son arranged it, Pat McGrady Jr., outstanding journalist who worked for Newsday. In fact, he was the Moscow News Bureau, and he was highly respected. No one had ever touched the American Cancer Society. No one thought anybody would play politics with people's lives. That's how much trust the American public had and the medical community had in the cancer establishment. And yet they were corrupt top to bottom. The whole cancer establishment was corrupt and is to this day. We wrote the article. Nobody would publish it. And then one day a guy from a newspaper on the West Side called Our Town, Ed Towns was his name, he published it. And it won an Investigative Journalist Award, and then someone from a major magazine, a friend of the publisher, came to me. And I met with the publisher. Everyone on his staff said, no, don't publish it, including his general counsel. Said, we'll get sued into oblivion, we'll lose $7 million in advertising. This man had a very soft voice, and he leans across the table to me, and he said, do you really believe that if we publish this information on alternative cancer therapies that we'll save lives? I said, sir, we'll save hundreds of thousands of lives. He then turned to his staff and says, we're going to publish. And they went ballistic. Oh, God, and one of them, I won't mention which one, out on the steps of this brownstone, which was Judy Garland's original home, He comes up to me and he punches his finger in my chest and says, "You will not publish this article in my magazine." I said, "Sir, it's not your magazines, it's the publisher, and yes, I'm going to publish it. No, you and I will never speak again." For 26 years, I never went into their offices, I never spoke with these people, I had no respect for them. We were never sued, contrary to their opinions. We did not lose advertising, contrary. We gained, and nobody had to buy the magazine. He would reprint just the article at his cost and mail it to anyone who wanted a free copy. So it was one of the most successful series of articles ever published in American history, in literary history. I had 58 cover stories alone. But that led to 2020 doing a double Emmy award winning on Dr. Stanislav Brzezinski. That saved lives. Dr. Lawrence Burton on 60 Minutes, my article. That saved lives. Gabe Pressman did a 10-part series. That saved lives. So that wouldn't have happened without Robert Houston. That wouldn't have happened without the little newspaper on the East Side publishing it. But I've never forgotten the fact that no liberal publication would touch it. So don't virtue shame in the future anyone saying, "Well, we publish, we broadcast it." No, nobody would touch anything. But then that challenged the entire cancer establishment, which doesn't deserve to exist today. We need a whole new approach to cancer, everything new. We need to invite those physicians and scientists who have proven with quality research and clinical experience that there are options for how you prevent cancer and how you treat cancer. I'm not telling people not to use chemotherapy or radiation or surgery, but I'm saying that we have to open it up for more options. Because otherwise, if we're losing right now, this year, more or less 600,000 people will die of cancer. All of them have taken the orthodox therapy. They've all been treated by the best and brightest oncologists. They've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars per their whole treatment. And yet, when you have that many people dying, if you go back the last 40 years, that's 20 million plus people who died who only used orthodox therapy. How can you say that you're so good, you have the treatment, you're making promises to people, and 20 million people have died? Wow, 20 million people. So we better look at the naked emperor. Finally, there are brain benefits of yoga compared to aerobic exercise. University of Illinois and Wayne State University both published an article in the journal Brain Plasticity that's revealed that regular yoga practice may impart the same functional benefits to your brain as aerobic exercise. Good for them. So yoga is very beneficial, and now we have the hard science to prove it. And by the way, probiotics provide anti-cancer effects. Cleveland Clinic's Genomic Medicine Institute, they looked at 400 species of bacteria in your belly and gut that can be the key to health and disease. The differences in the bacterial makeup of the breast tissue in those with breast cancer point to the existence of a microbiome within the breast. This is brand new information. No one's ever heard this. You're getting this exclusively first today. So your breast has its own microbiome. We didn't know that. We only thought the gut had it. And as well as the prospect of probiotic use in the battle against disease. So now we can have a more personalized diagnosis of the individual's microbiome to determine what probiotics are needed to provide balance and prevent disease. And that is good news, brand new information. And so, for women undergoing breast surgery, the role of probiotics may provide some much-needed benefit in post-surgical infections. According to an article published recently, last month, quote, "would be a great interest and importance to examine the precise mechanisms and correlate the reported alterations of the microbiome with the infectious complications in the surgical and critical ill patient," end quote. And by the way, additionally, the microbiome's role in breastfeeding is well established, with the interplay between the gut and the breast microbiota crucial breastfeeding and infant development. The breastfeeding mother's gut microbiome has a crucial role in her offspring's immune development. In addition, distinct sites in and around the breast, such as the breast skin tissue, swabs, and cheek swabs, are known to have unique microbiome signatures. So these microbiomes reside within breast tissue, irrespective of a history of infection or lactation. We are 30 minutes into our program. I'm Gary Nall. A little longer today on health and healing. But now we're going to take a break. And when we come back from the break, I want you to hear a little bit from James Corbett about contact tracing and why it could be setting us up so that, well, you hear him say it, but I'll say it myself at the beginning here. If they demand that you get a test taken that is faulty, and then you test positive even though you're completely healthy, and you may have had a cold 20 years ago, but now they're saying you're infected, now you must be traced. And if you refuse this being traced by these thousands of people per state who are out there being hired to track you and trace everyone you've been in contact with, then they can demand that you be mandatorily vaccinated or quarantined with punishment. That's where this is going. Back in a moment with that segment. Please stay with us.
Welcome back to the Corbett Report. I am James Corbett of CorbettReport.com with another edition of Propaganda Watch. Stop me if you've heard this one at all in the past few weeks. Contact tracing. I'm willing to bet you have heard about contact tracing in the past few weeks. I'm also willing to bet it is a term that you have never heard before in your life prior to the last few weeks. Something to cogitate on, and I have a remarkably profound but remarkably simple observation about that coming up for you. But for those who have somehow managed to miss this term, contact tracing, and its definition, well, why take it from me? Let's take it from the Clinton Global Initiative.
One of the elements, key elements, in your plan to be able to reopen California, and I liked it, by the way, because you didn't overpromise. You didn't promise you could do things you couldn't, and you made it clear that unless you could do it without more people getting sick and dying, it couldn't be done. But one of the things that you have to be able to do is to track people who are positive. Where were they? Who were they in contact with? How can you hem up any recurrence of this? Massachusetts has recently announced that they're going to try to build a statewide tracking program, and they've asked partners in health to run it for them. And they're one of my partners in the work we've done in Africa, Haiti, and other places. But where are we going to get all these contact tracers? Should we have, like you did with California did with the Conservation Corps of young people, should we have a contract tracer corps, even if we call it something more elegant? Should we really build the first public health network we've ever really built in this country around this issue?
I think the answer is absolutely yes. And I love the Massachusetts example. We were able to learn from them. We're all sharing best practices in real time. But this is an interesting point that's often not brought up. We have tracing capacity that predates COVID-19. It goes back to SARS, measles, TB, et cetera. Tracking and tracing capacity that exists in the county levels primarily, and increasing capacity at the state level. So what we're doing is we're building off that existing infrastructure and using the tools of technology to overlay. In addition to that, we're using AmeriCorps specifically. I thank you as a champion for AmeriCorps for decades. We've been able to take advantage of that workforce, obviously our conservation corps. What we have now is called Cal Volunteers. In the spirit of Sarge Shriver, we are asking people, thousands of folks, to be part of this new corps, to get trained and to help us with the tracing, because you're absolutely right. The predicate for getting back to some semblance of normalcy is our ability to identify individuals through testing, to be able to trace their contacts, to isolate individuals that have either been exposed or quarantined people that are tested positive. And that's just going to require an army of folks and the capacity of consideration from individuals to allow for their privacy to be impacted by that kind of acuity of attention based upon where they've been and who they talk to.
Oh, yes. Contact tracing. Is that what they're calling it now? Because it seems to me that this is the nightmare panopticon total surveillance grid that crazy conspiracy theorists have been warning about the creation of for decades now. But no, no, you silly conspiracy theorists, you were completely wrong. That never existed and you were crazy and paranoid for even caring about it. But, oh, here it is, and it's now called contact tracing. You see how this works. This leads to a remarkably profound and remarkably simple observation about propaganda. Propaganda is PR. All propaganda is, stripped down to its bare bones, is a marketing campaign designed to sell an otherwise unpalatable idea to the public. If it was palatable in its pure form, they wouldn't need a marketing campaign surrounding it. They wouldn't need to dress it up and call it something else and give it a fancy name and introduce it in some PR glitzy way. No, they would just state it openly and plainly. The fact that there is a marketing campaign that surrounds an idea shows you that it is propaganda of some sort, designed to make you accept an idea that you would otherwise be resistant to. And one of the simplest and most effective marketing techniques for unpalatable ideas is to simply name that idea something else and then present it in a context where it seems to be good, so that you can take something that literally for decades, for half a century at least, maybe more, go back to 1984. I mean, I know it's referenced every few minutes these days, but it's because it is wildly appropriate for the times that we are living in. People have understood for generations that the creation of a panopticon grid of total surveillance is an absolute nightmare. There is no other way to understand what the creation of such a grid of total surveillance other than as a nightmare scenario. Unless, of course, you're dealing with the event that changed the world as we know it, and the entire rules of civilization are going to have to be rewritten because of the dramatic events that have taken place in Pandemic One, as Bill Gates has just rebranded, is attempting to essentially market the propaganda campaign around SARS-CoV-2. It's now Pandemic One, which of course implies there's going to be a Pandemic Two, doesn't it? Makes you wonder what Bill Gates is up to, doesn't it? But at any rate, yes, there is a marketing campaign surrounding Pandemic One, and one aspect of that is to rebrand the complete and total government surveillance of everything you do, everywhere you go, everyone you talk to, everything you purchase, and everything else to do with your actual physical meat space life. The total surveillance they're going to repackage as contact tracing, which, again, is a term that you've never heard before in your life, so you don't have any pre-associations or baggage around that term. It's not surveillance. It's not some sort of invasive thing. It's just contact tracing. Well, that sounds rather passive, doesn't it? And of course, it embeds with it a million pieces of very, very worrying data, doesn't it? So, yes, the Clinton Global Initiative is just one of many, many outlets that is trying to introduce this idea to the public discourse right now and framing the way that those words are being introduced to the public. So I would invite you, just as an experiment, just type the words contact tracing into a news search, any sort of search or news search that you tend to use, just type those words in and read some of the many, many entries that are coming out right now, some of which are saying, well, lawmakers have some concerns about the ways that contact tracing could be used by the big tech companies because they might not respect your privacy. But of course, that's coming from the government saying, don't worry, guys, we're the good guys. We'll totally be trustworthy when it comes to tracking and tracing everything you go, everyone you meet. Don't worry, we can be relied on. It's just those big tech guys that aren't, I don't know about them. Of course, they're in the back pocket of government, and government's in their back pocket anyway. It's all one big corporate fascistic stew. But let's disregard all of that, and let's make the debate about who should be entrusted with all the data about everywhere you are going at all times of every day. And only for the duration of the crisis, right? Because they will never, ever again use this fear of some sort of new contagion to flip the switch back on and to re-enable all of the controls that they are putting in right now, right? Oh, of course, that is exactly what is going to happen. Powers that are taken by the government, as we should all know by now, will never be relinquished. They will never give up on this complete and total surveillance of every person in the population at all times once it has been put in their hands. And you would be an absolute naive simpleton who fell off a turnip truck yesterday if you believe that to be the case. So, that being established, yes, I will direct you to that full video of the Clinton Global Initiative University combating the COVID-19 crisis, which has a lot of nuggets embedded in it. But I will specifically point you to contact tracing with the Clintons, which is an example of just those, some of the choicest nuggets about contact tracing that are embedded in that longer 4-hour video. This is a 7-minute video that was put together by Corbett Report member Camille at...
Okay, just to let you know that the new reset that is being discussed across the United States, across the world, is really about having us accept quarantines, isolation, getting in line, mandatory testing, mandatory vaccines, and attacking anyone who challenges any of this, no matter what your truth is, no matter what proof you have that the establishment is wrong, you who have the truth will be the enemy of the state. That's what's going on. I have more to share with you, a lot more to share with you, but I want to share something new. We had a very successful webinar several weeks ago, and then a month before that, the biggest webinar we've had in years. And so I simply asked the people in the audience, what would you like to have discussed? And the number one thing that came back of all the issues was pain, managing pain naturally. So this coming Sunday at 11 a.m., we will be doing a webinar worldwide, and registration is closing this Sunday at 11. The webinar is at noon. So this coming Sunday at noon, a live webinar, Managing Pain Naturally, all kinds of pain. You'll be shown a documentary. I'll do a detailed lecture, and I'll have plenty of time, as I always do, to answer all of your questions about pain. I'll be offering protocols and insights, and so a lot of information will be shared. So if you'd like to understand that every day millions of people start or end their day with some condition of chronic pain, it might be musculoskeletal or arthritic or due to previous injury or mental, etc., although conventional medicine more often than not prescribes medications and painkillers, these simply mask the symptoms and contribute nothing towards getting a pain underlying cause corrected. I'll be sharing natural approaches for pain relief and treatment. For many types of pain, there's an underlying layer of stress. So reducing or even eradicating stress can relieve pain for many people, but there are also other approaches. I'll go into acupuncture, psychosomatic therapies, nutrition, supplements, botanicals, everything. Plus, they'll have a whole discussion on reversing pain completely. Call this number if you'd like to join, because all of my webinars are always packed. This Sunday, the 18th, at noon, call 877-627-5065. Again, that's 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065 for the live webinar, Managing Pain Naturally. All pain from migraines, cluster headaches, back pain, arthritic pain, PMS pain, I'm dealing with all of it, even pain from cancer. So that's that. Now, from Les Jamieson, one of America's leading environmental activists. He just sent me this. There are now 10 franchises which have installed 8,200 wireless antennas throughout the five boroughs, with a total of 11,600 being the goal they're doing. And he sent photographs over. And I recognize some of these buildings because two of them are on the Upper West Side. And so we urge people to challenge the legitimacy of these 4G, 5G antennas throughout Harlem, the Village, Midtown, and Brooklyn. And there are there's a website that I'll recommend you go to. It's called OurTownOurChoice.org/New York/WTF. Okay? OurTownOurChoice, all one word, .org. OurTownOurChoice.org/NY/WTF. So if you watch the Financial Channel, according to a list, CNBC for the past hour or so, they've been hyping all the latest tech company news on 5G. And one commentator took an opposing opinion, citing the fact that 5G isn't fully implemented yet. However, this led to the closing line saying that 2021 will be the year 5G really becomes reality. So listen, everyone in this audience, now is the time to get informed and get active. If you're wondering what to do, you can begin by calling your New York City council member, your New York State senator and assembly member, the mayor's office, and members of Congress. Tell them that 5G is about to create a pandemic from bombarding us with pulsed, modulated microwave radiation that will make COVID-19 look like a minor sneeze. And two, we already paid Verizon for fiber optic cable networks that are faster, more secure, and more reliable than 5G wireless technology, and therefore we demand an immediate moratorium. If you're ready to mobilize, New York, 4Wired Tech is working on several initiatives with a coalition. We would make the difference. In the meantime, please spread the word. And we've got to get the word out against 5G. Also, from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, just today from the Grilling School of Global Public Health, they're suggesting that a strain of coronavirus that has recently been alarming the swine industry, that means pigs, may have the potential to spread to humans as well. Quote, the coronavirus strain, known as swine acute diarrhea syndrome coronavirus, has emerged from bats and has been infecting swine herds throughout China since it was first discovered in 2016. The virus causes severe diarrhea and vomiting and has been especially deadly to young piglets. Outbreaks of such an illness have the potential to wreak economic havoc to many countries across the globe that rely upon the pork industry. Though it is in the same family of viruses as the beta coronavirus, SARS-2, which causes the respiratory illness COVID-19 in humans, SADS-CoV is an alpha coronavirus that causes gastrointestinal illness in pigs. SADS-CoV is also distinct from two circulating common cold alpha coronaviruses in humans, the 229E and the NL63. And while SADS has not been known to affect humans to date, the COVID-19 pandemic serves as a, listen carefully, a potent reminder that many coronavirus strains found in animals have the potential to infect humans as well, an effect known as spillover. This is the most important, and this comes from a professor of virology, Ralph Barrick, and as well as William Kennan, distinguished professor of epidemiology at Grilling School. Quote, listen carefully. While many investigators focus upon the emergent potential of the beta coronaviruses like SARS and MERS, actually the alpha coronaviruses may prove equally prominent, if not greater, concerns to human health given their potential to rapidly jump between species. All right? Meaning that Now that you have a form of coronavirus in pigs, that is no longer debatable. It is absolute. And knowing that pigs are common throughout the United States because more and more people are eating pork, and it's a major mainstream of the diet in China and other countries, you have to be concerned. You need to be concerned. This is really serious. Therefore, advocate for yourself a plant-based healthy diet. It is not our job, nor our right, to demand people go from a meat-based diet, including pork, to a plant-based diet. All that we can do, without being self-righteous or antagonistic, is to encourage people to make a healthier choice and be examples that the healthy vegans, the healthy plant-based people, have stronger immune systems, are less likely to come down ill with the normal viruses every year, live longer lives. All this is in the scientific literature, and have less comorbidities. And it's the comorbidities that put you at greater risk of infection and even dying. If you're comorbid and older, you're a higher risk of dying from your comorbidities in association with COVID-19. So I just wanted to share the information because this is not being disseminated everywhere that it should be. And also, Virginia is preparing for an unprecedented vaccination campaign. And quickly I'll share some of the plans. This is from NBC News. Quote, Virginia's planned release to the Mercury Friday shows the size and scale of a public health campaign designed to protect millions against a historic virus. The plan was submitted to the federal CDC for review this week and remains, quote, a living document as more information is understood, more vaccines are introduced, and any other considerations develop. That's according to the Virginia Department of Health Deputy Commissioner. And the plan also underscores many of the factors that health workers will contend with when it comes to distributing any future vaccine. So if you live in the state of New York, California, and Virginia, I would surmise from what is occurring and what is being propagated and progenitored that you will be mandated to take a corona test that is inaccurate, highly unreliable, and unscientific, and if positive, which probably will be the case, even though you will not have any disease, you will then be given a mandated vaccine where you cannot refuse it, or you could be permanently quarantined with something like a monitoring bracelet to make sure you don't leave your home or taken to another facility. That's how bad I see it becoming. I hope I'm wrong, but I don't believe I am. And by the way, quote from the Federalist, the CDC study finds overwhelming majority of people getting coronaviruses wore masks. Quote, the CDC report released in September shows that masks and face coverings are not effective in preventing the spread of COVID, even for those people who consistently wear them. A study conducted in the United States in July found that when they compared 154 case patients who tested positive for corona to a control group of 160 participants from the same healthcare facility who were symptomatic but tested negative, over 70% of the case patients were contaminated with the virus and fell ill despite always wearing a mask. In the 14 days before the illness onset, 71% of case patients, 74% of control patients reported always using cloth face coverings or mask types in public. In addition, over 14% of case patients said they, quote, often wore face covering and were still infected with the virus. The study also demonstrates that under 4% of case patients became sick with the virus, even though they, quote, never wore a mask or face covering. So despite over 70% of the case patient participants' efforts to follow CDC recommendations by committing to always wearing face coverings at gatherings with 10 persons and or more, and in home they wore masks, and shopping, dining at restaurants, going to an office setting, salon, gym, whatever, they still contracted with the face mask the virus. All right? One more challenge to the status quo. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening and have a nice day.